The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And on paper, these units look the same. You know, each one is organized the same. And they're run by people who on paper look the same. A series of infantry lieutenant colonels who have gone to the same schools, have been in the same units, had a lot of the same previous experiences. But they're different people. And the personalities of commanders, especially in kind of remote places where the commander is really left to make a lot of decisions themselves, compared to, say, Baghdad, where there's a ton of battalions running around, a single battalion commander in the Pech Valley can have a much more outsized effect on just everything that's happening around him. So you'll find that, you know, one battalion commander may get along really well with Afghans, may be really interested in dealing with them, may sort of be much more engaged in the nuances of local politics. And then the next battalion commander, who's a guy with the same resume, comes in and is much more black and white thinker, much more invested in just trying to, you know, everybody who's sitting on the fence needs to get off the fence and either, you know, pick the side of the government, U.S.-backed government, or pick the side of the Taliban. And so units that on a PowerPoint slide look like they're doing the same thing, in fact, are doing very, very different things.
I'm Bryce Clem, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. I sat down recently with Wesley Morgan, a former military affairs reporter at Politico, and author of the new book, The Hardest Place, The American Military Adrift in Afghanistan's Pech Valley. Wesley and I talked about the evolution of the war in Afghanistan, from the United States' early hunt for Osama bin Laden to the increased use of drone strikes during the Obama and Trump administrations. We also discussed the current state of the war in Afghanistan, including the fight against the Islamic State's Afghanistan affiliate. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 10th, America's War in Afghanistan's Pech Valley. So before we get to the book, I have to ask, how did you come to find yourself reporting from Afghanistan when you were still a college student?
Well, early on when I was in college, I had a weird opportunity to go over and start covering the war, first in Iraq and later in Afghanistan, as a freelancer. I was very interested in the wars. You know, 9/11 happened when I was 14 years old, I think it was, maybe 13. And so I knew that I wanted to get over and see them and see how they were happening. The obvious route into that was, you know, when I got to college, I joined ROTC thinking, you know, this is the direct path. This is the well-paved path to get over into these wars. But then in the summer of 2007, after my freshman year, had an interesting opportunity to get over to cover the summer of the surge as a freelancer. And then that seemed like a better fit. And also maybe more prominent in my mind right at that moment was it was immediate. So I started spending my summers going, you know, two trips to Iraq, then first to Afghanistan in 2009, second time to Afghanistan in 2010. And that was the 2010 trip was when I first visited the Pech Valley.
Great. So you were, you know, around 20 years old when you first started doing this. What were some of the reactions that people had to seeing you there?
Well, I would say, I mean, I was mostly, you know, embedding with infantry platoons, cavalry platoons, things like that, where the soldiers themselves were about my age. So it was not as sort of freaked out a reaction as you might expect. People back at headquarters and, you know, real reporters who knew what they were doing were obviously surprised to see me. But, you know, you'd get out to one of these little platoons, and as long as you weren't a huge pain in the ass and didn't, you know, make any trouble or cause anything to be unsafe for yourself or others, you're just another attachment of, you know, endless cast of attachments who would come and tag along with their platoons.
Right, right. So when exactly did you first go to the Pech Valley?
It was the summer of 2010, so it was the first summer of the major surge that President Obama had announced in December 2009 in his West Point speech.
Great, great. So the book tells the story of the Pech Valley, and for our listeners who might not know the geography of Afghanistan, where is the Pech Valley? And if you could, just give our listeners sort of a general overview of the region, the surrounding valleys, main industry, the languages spoken there.
Sure. So if you go northeast from Kabul toward the Pakistani border, you'll hit these two provinces, Kunar and Nuristan, that are up on the border there, quite remote, very rugged, mountainous provinces. And the Pech Valley flows down from Nuristan into Kunar and joins the Kunar River at the city of Asadabad, which is the Kunar's provincial capital. So it's this long, curving river, and it has a variety of tributaries that are more famous than it is, with names like the Korangal, the Wygal, the Shuryak, where some of the, you know, very disastrous events in the war have happened, like the Battle of Wannat in 2008 and the Operation Red Wings episode in 2005. The Pech and its tributaries are an interesting place in terms of who lives there and what languages are spoken, which is something that comes into play in the book in terms of Afghanistan itself being a difficult place for U.S. troops and intelligence officers to understand what's going on around them, and then this area of the country being, you know, much more so because of the language problems. People on the main valley floor mostly speak Pashto. They're Safi Pashtuns. Up in the side valleys to the north and south of the Pech, there are a lot of much smaller languages that have no written form that are Peshai languages and Nuristani languages that were very, very difficult for American troops to find interpreters who spoke those languages and whom they could trust or whom they felt they could trust.
So why did you decide to write this book about the Pech Valley specifically?
Well, the Pech really caught my attention the first time I visited there in 2010 for a few reasons. One was just how beautiful the terrain is. It's an extremely jagged looking place. It has a lot of vegetation that you don't see in very many other parts of Afghanistan, big forests, all this kind of stuff. And also it was incredibly violent. It was in a particular way that I hadn't seen in many other parts of Iraq or Afghanistan. It was not a big IED hotspot, but it was a place where a tremendous amount of artillery was being expended in these long-range gunfights, U.S. troops on the valley floor, insurgents in the mountains, just duking it out with huge amounts of ordnance. And so when I visited there in 2010, it was kind of at this peak moment of U.S. involvement there, where U.S. forces were buttoned down in their little outposts with their concrete walls. The Taliban were up in the hills. They knew exactly how long it would take for U.S. air support to arrive. And so they were just shelling each other constantly at this heavy volume. But by that point, for the most part, the people who were really being harmed by this were just the people who lived in the valley who were caught in the middle and who would get hit by short rounds and things like that. So it was kind of this stalemate. And it was fairly obvious to see in the valley that it was this stalemate. And kind of remarkably to me at the time, the battalion commander in the valley acknowledged that this was the case, which in the summer of the surge in Afghanistan, you know, I would travel around a lot, and in most places, these units that I visited in Kandahar, Paktika, Helmand, these other places, they were spreading out. They were building new outposts, new roads, taking the fight to the enemy, and their commanders would kind of, you know, parrot these statistics and talk about how well they were doing and what a better situation they were going to hand off to the next commander. And this was kind of the vibe of the Afghan surge. But in the Pech Valley, the battalion commander there, a guy named Joe Ryan, who appears repeatedly through the book, he was pretty open about his belief that U.S. forces had, you know, reached a point of diminishing returns in this particular place, that they had worn out their welcome and it was time to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I want to jump in here and sort of rewind a little bit and explain the evolution of the conflict up until that point that you said you got there in 2010. So why did the Pech play such an important role in the United States' initial campaign in Afghanistan right after 9/11?
Sure. So Kunar, the province in which the Pech is located, it turns out that was the place that Osama bin Laden went after he fled from the Battle of Tora Bora in December 2001, where he escaped U.S. bombardment. So in 2002, U.S. Special Operations Forces and intelligence officers were trying to figure out where bin Laden had gone after Tora Bora. And one of the places that they attempted to follow him was Kunar, which was actually the correct guess, but they were always a few steps behind him. But so Kunar, along with a couple of other places in the Afghan East, wound up being places where the Joint Special Operations Command and the CIA set up these little intelligence collection and reconnaissance outposts very, very early on in the spring of 2002. And then from there, it kind of was just like a snowball that kept rolling. Different units would come in and inherit these little outposts, and their missions would expand in these little increments often without a whole lot of, you know, bigger picture thought about where this was leading.
Yeah. And so the book describes sort of how this evolved into hunting for different local militia leaders. You know, who were some of the people that they were looking for?
Well, initially, when Special Operations Forces and intelligence guys first showed up in 2002, they were looking for anybody who might be able to tell them where anybody from Al-Qaeda had gone from Tora Bora. So they were just sort of scooping people up based on intelligence tips they were getting from whoever would talk to them or whoever they could pay for intelligence. And there was not an active insurgency at that point. I mean, the Taliban had not been especially active in Kunar in the first place, and neither had Al-Qaeda. So it's not like this was, you know, the southern Pashtun heartland where there was just this kind of built-in resistance. It took a little while for an insurgency to get going there. Initially, a lot of what was happening was U.S. troops were detaining people, often based on erroneous intelligence or intelligence that they were being fed by people with ulterior motives.
And what might some of those ulterior motives be?
So one of the biggest threads that runs through this story is the role of the trade in illegal timber in Kunar and in the Pech, in particular the Korangal Valley. Now, the reason that the timber trade itself became illegal is kind of a complicated story that has to do with international actors being played by local actors in the conflict. So essentially what happens is Kunar has these beautiful conifer forests up on the upper slopes of the mountains. And the cedar that grows in them, in particular, the Himalayan cedar, is really good construction wood. It's great for, you know, furniture, you know, for doorways, for all kinds of things. And it's always been used for those purposes by the people who live there. But starting in the 1980s, it also became wood that sort of fueled the anti-Soviet jihad. Because essentially wealthy people in the Gulf, it would be advertised to them as, look, if you buy your cedar for your place from, you know, Kunari cedar, you'll be funding the Mujahideen. And so this timber industry became this bigger international thing. And by the time U.S. troops showed up, it was big business. And it was a big business from which there was the people who were actually cutting the timber up in places like the Korangal. And there were people on the valley floors whose role it was to get the timber from its point of origin to Pakistan, where it could then be sold off to the Gulf. And so what wound up happening was U.S. troops got caught up in business disputes and business machinations between these parties. It would be used as muscle by one side or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how did the United States military's sort of relationship with the timber industry there evolve up until 2010?
Well, initially what it was U.S. forces partnered up with the people who wanted to partner with them, who were essentially valley floor strongmen. Guys, there's a guy named Haji Jahandad and a guy named Malik Zareen were the two biggest ones. And they used U.S. forces to act against their rivals and against the people from whom they were purchasing the timber who were cutting it. What happened was in the Korangal, which is the kind of the case study that I use and the most dramatic example, Haji Jahandad brought in U.S. forces to help enforce new terms, new business terms on the Korangalis. And the Korangalis, in turn, brought in the Taliban to help them fend this situation off. And from there, the Korangal becomes this arena in which U.S. and Taliban forces just fight constantly.
And so for our listeners who might not remember exactly, what was Operation Red Wings?
Sure. So in June 2005, there was a mission that went terribly wrong up on the mountain above the Korangal Valley, where a reconnaissance team of Navy SEALs, four SEALs, was found out and overrun by local militants in the area. And then when a pair of helicopters full of additional SEALs came to try and find them, one of these helicopters was shot down with the loss of 16 American troops aboard. So 19 guys died on this one day. At that point, not very many Americans had died in Afghanistan up to that point in the war. And it really shifted the whole tone of U.S. involvement in the country. And it kind of just shifted the stakes, made it clear how much more lethal this budding insurgency was going to be.
Yeah, so for our listeners who might remember, Operation Red Wings is described at length in the book Lone Survivor and then the subsequent movie. So how did the failure of Operation Red Wings really come to inform U.S. strategy in the Pech specifically?
Well, one thing that it did, and this is a phenomenon that you see over and over in different parts of Afghanistan, is it elevated the profile of one particular fairly small-time militant whom the SEALs had been going after. they've been going after this guy. His name was Ahmad Shah, or at least that was the name that he was operating under. And he was a guy who was making a name for himself in the Pech Valley, laying IEDs, targeting the Marines who were patrolling there all the time. But by virtue of having brought down a helicopter, killed 19 Americans, and having video showing the aftermath of this, he was able both to parlay himself into a bigger position in the insurgency by bringing this sort of gold propaganda material to the attention of Taliban and Al-Qaeda media arms in Peshawar in Pakistan. And then also, I mean, U.S. forces wanted to get him. He had exacted a terrible cost in U.S. lives, and they wanted to get him. And so he became a high-profile target, probably out of proportion to how important he really was on the battlefield for a couple of years. And U.S. forces, he was up there on the list with Al-Qaeda figures. And this kind of brought the Korangal more into focus and made the Korangal more a place where U.S. forces were interested in going, and helped kind of feed this, what the military would call like a self-licking ice cream cone. You know, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy of military focuses more on the Korangal. Korangal gets more violent, military focuses on it more, et cetera.
So following Operation Red Wings, like you just said, the fight in the Pech Valley became a self-licking ice cream cone. I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that development and the sort of strategy that the U.S. troops had of operating out of these only accessible by helicopter forward operating bases, and they would go out on patrol and sort of go look for militia.
Sure. So part of what happens here is there's a phenomenon of U.S. units rotating in and out, and the strategy and tactics changing as new headquarters arrive and old ones leave. So about 9 months after Operation Red Wings in the spring of 2006, the 10th Mountain Division arrives in Afghanistan for a year-long rotation, what's meant to be a year-long rotation. And they kind of see the Korangal as a cancer that needs to be excised from northeastern Afghanistan, a problem, a sanctuary area for militants like Ahmad Shah and an Al-Qaeda figure named Abu Ikhlas that they need to go into and fix. So they do. In the spring of 2006, a large operation occurs, multiple battalions of U.S. troops, and they build a new outpost in the Korangal Valley. Now, the idea that they're thinking in the long term is that this will be a place that they're going to turn over to the Afghan army, but there really isn't much of an Afghan army at this point. And long before anything like that can become a reality, the Korangal just rejects the presence of U.S. forces there. It becomes an outpost that is constantly fought over all the time, constantly attacked, and becomes this magnet for firefights. By 2007, when the outpost has been there for a year or so, a huge proportion of U.S. air support missions being flown over Afghanistan on any given day, and a huge proportion of the bombs being dropped on Afghanistan on any given day, were in support of this one infantry company that was duking it out in the Korangal Valley.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You paint that picture really vividly in the book. I was wondering if you could, sort of something that we've been talking around a little bit, you know, it wasn't just the U.S. military and the Taliban and these militias in these areas. What were some of the initial incidents where the U.S. military sort of lost the trust of the local population?
Yeah, so a thread that runs throughout the book is the harm that is done to the strategy by the harm that American troops inadvertently do to civilians in airstrikes, inadvertent shootings, artillery missions that go wrong, raids based on false intelligence, any number of things. And these almost always are good faith mistakes. And initially, a lot of Afghan communities kind of are willing to look past them. There's an example in the book in 2004 when a Green Beret captain shoots a man in the head by mistake. It's a ricochet round. A dog has attacked the Green Beret captain. He shoots the dog. The bullet goes through the dog, hits a rock, and hits a shop owner square in the forehead. The Green Beret captain is immediately worried that the town is going to, you know, to riot, to kick the team out. But in fact, they don't. The town understands that it was an honest mistake, and it pretty much slides. Now, as this happens over and over and over again, variations on this, sometimes in much deadlier incidents, an AC-130 airstrike out in the forest that kills a bunch of children in the middle of the night because on the surveillance feed, it was not clear that they were children. Towns become obviously much less willing to forgive and forget.
Yeah, and one thing you sort of touched on was how different commanders' styles in the region affected their relationship with the local population. I was wondering if you could describe that a little bit.
Yeah, so there's a period of time when one U.S. infantry battalion after another is rotating through this place. And on paper, these units look the same. You know, each one is organized the same. And they're run by people who on paper look the same. A series of infantry lieutenant colonels who have gone to the same schools, have been in the same units, had a lot of the same previous experiences. but they're different people. And the personalities of commanders, especially in kind of remote places where the commander is really left to make a lot of decisions themselves, compared to, say, Baghdad, where there's a ton of battalions running around, a single battalion commander in the Pesh Valley can have a much more outsized effect on just everything that's happening around him. And so you'll find that, you know, one battalion commander may get along really well with Afghans, may be really interested in dealing with them, may sort of be much more engaged in the nuances of local politics. And then the next battalion commander, who's a guy with the same resume, comes in and is much more black and white thinker, much more invested in just trying to, you know, everybody who's sitting on the fence needs to get off the fence and either, you know, pick the side of the government, US-backed government, or pick the side of the Taliban. And so units that on a PowerPoint slide look like they're doing the same thing, in fact, are doing very, very different things.
Right. And at the same time, the United States, as you sort of mentioned, was fighting the war in Iraq. And I'm curious, how did the war in Iraq and maybe even specifically the 2007 surge impact the war in the Pesh Valley?
Initially, not a lot. Afghanistan in general was kind of a forgotten theater in 2006 and 2007. It was stripped for resources. There were very few troops there, very few helicopters, drones, all kinds of things like that. So in some sense, the biggest effect of the surge in 2007 was just the fact that Afghanistan was such a more of an economy of force theater. I mean, troops were left to do much more with less. Now, during this period, U.S. units in Afghanistan adopted some of the same so-called population-centric counterinsurgency tactics that U.S. troops in Iraq were famously using during the surge. But in many cases, they kind of came to these independently. I mean, the 10th Mountain Division units that built all these outposts in 2006 did so before the release of the counterinsurgency manual, before the surge in Iraq, just because they had commanders who'd been reading up on the same kinds of mid-century counterinsurgency tactics and materials that informed the counterinsurgency manual and the counterinsurgency strategy in Iraq.
Yeah, and there was also significant problems in both Iraq and Afghanistan with IEDs, which led to the sort of abandonment of the Humvee and developed a vehicle called the MRAP that was supposed to be, you know, built to better withstand an IED explosion. But why was the MRAP particularly ill-suited for fighting in the Pesh?
So the MRAP is a vehicle that, you know, originates in the Southern African Bush Wars in the 1970s as a vehicle that's better suited to absorb blasts from below. And they came into service in Iraq and were rushed into service in large numbers by Defense Secretary Bob Gates during the surge era, and they saved countless lives. I mean, they were an incredibly useful tool in Iraq. And they were in parts of Afghanistan also. But they're much bigger, clunkier, heavier vehicles. And the roads we're talking about in places like the Pesh Valley and the Kunar Valley often just can't take them. The fact that the Army kind of enforced this as a cookie-cutter solution rather than saying, okay, infantry company commander, you can decide whether you want to use MRAPs or Humvees or pickup trucks. The necessity of preventing casualties caused the Army to mandate that units be going outside the wire in MRAPs all the time. And this gradually just restricted how far these units could reach from their bases. Whereas, you know, earlier in the war, they had been going on ATVs and pickup trucks up to very remote places in the mountains, or sometimes on multi-day foot patrols. Now it becomes, you can't go much farther than where the MRAPs can go on the main road.
Right. And how did that really, that sort of limited their, you know, their ability to travel, like you said, sort of far outside the bases. How did that affect U.S. strategy in sort of the later 2000s up to 2010?
Well, I think it affected it in ways that were not deliberate and that were almost imperceptible as it was happening, because units would come in and this was all they knew. They inherited a bunch of MRAPs. They're using a bunch of MRAPs. The farthest that they can go is the farthest that the unit before them could go in their MRAPs. But it's more visible to, there are some, you know, there are people, longtime Kunar hands, whether it's interpreters or asymmetric warfare group advisors, who describe the progression that they saw to me, where essentially U.S. forces just became much more buttoned up inside their vehicles and their outposts, much less willing to take risks. And the population in turn became much, much less willing to take risks on their behalf, to provide intelligence, to cooperate. And it becomes just a much more standoffish dynamic.
Now, you describe sort of how the war in the Pesh changes pretty significantly around 2010. What was changing from sort of the U.S. outpost system, and what was it like being there during the change?
Well, I would say, I mean, I first went to Afghanistan in 2009 as this change was really already significantly underway. I mean, I did not see the kind of the resource-strapped war of the pre-Obama administration era. You know, when I first went to the Pech, these outposts that had begun their lives as really just very improvised little roadside encampments had grown up into these fortresses with concrete walls and so on. And so you were ensconced within these little bubbles of protection that felt safe to the troops living there. And by comparison, everything outside felt much and much, 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 much less safe. So villages that previously had been friendly that existed, you know, a mile outside the outpost or a couple of kilometers outside the outpost now feel almost like they're on another planet in our hostile territory.
Right. And how did President Obama announced a drawdown in 2011? How did that really affect the U.S. outposts in the Pech?
So throughout the war, often the Pech has been a little bit ahead of everything else that's going on in the country. So U.S. forces had already executed a major pullout from the Pech earlier in 2011 before Obama's announced the end of the surge. But what the announcement of the end of the surge did was it actually kind of pushed the next unit, so not the unit that had executed this withdrawal earlier in the year, but the new unit that had come in, to kind of feel like, look, the next unit after us is not going to have very many forces. It's on us to go back up into the mountains one more time and take the fight to the enemy. So later in 2011, there were a series of very big air assault operations, you know, helicopter-borne missions up into the hills that deposit hundreds of troops up into these remote places that are almost like just on steroids examples of operations that have been going on in these valleys for years to little effect. And they really have no greater effect in 2011, except in one case, one of these operations resulted in some pretty significant civilian casualties.
Right. And in the U.S., you know, after they pull out of the Pech, the Afghan National Army sort of stepped in their shoes. How did they fare in the Pech?
That's right. So when the 101st Airborne Division pulled out of the Pech in early 2011, they essentially did it in a rushed fashion. They did it in the only way they could. They had gotten the overall headquarters, ISAF, in Kabul to sign off on it, but it wasn't well coordinated with the Afghan government. And so there was this divergence between the idea that the U.S. commanders had, which was, we're done with this place, we're not accomplishing anything, this is a stalemate, we're leaving, and the importance of the Pech to the Afghan government, which was, this is a place that contains three or more district centers. It contains significant voting populations. It has symbolic importance. So when U.S. forces left, the Afghan troops did not leave. And those Afghan troops pretty quickly collapsed and just were almost completely under siege out at the main outpost that had previously been the safest and most secure outpost for U.S. forces in the Pech. And this drew U.S. forces back in. They had to send advisor teams back out, reestablish their base at the, you know, the place that they had left 6 months earlier, and take another year to kind of do it right.
And at this point, you know, a lot of the people from earlier in the U.S.'s war in Afghanistan have been coming back, started to come back and you know, in different roles there. I was wondering, in your conversations with them, how were they feeling about how the war was going at this point in, you know, around 2011 to 2012?
Yeah, I mean, you get this phenomenon that I saw in Kunar and the Pech of guys who really want to come back, not just to Afghanistan, but to the specific place that they fought previously, because it's a fascinating place. The combat there is really intense. So, you know, some guys kind of come back just because they enjoyed that first deployment. They know it's a thrill they're not going to find in other units or in other theaters. And so they would engineer a way to come, you know, figure out which the next unit that was going to the area was and get into that unit. Now, there's another case is for very different motives. There's a guy in the book named Lauren Crow, who was a platoon leader in Kunar in 2008 to 2009, and then came back in 2011 to 2012 as a captain and eventually a company commander. And for him, I mean, as I talked to him, and like all of these guys who did multiple deployments, he's a key character in the book. He had sort of seen and felt the futility of it in 2008 to 2009, when U.S. forces were not coordinating with Afghan forces, were not doing much with them. And he came back in part because he wanted to see if there were, you know, apply the lessons he'd learned the first time and try to do it better, in particular, working more closely with Afghan forces.
Right, right. And do you think that they took back a lot of these leaders, like Crow, took back a lot of lessons that they had from the first time? Because one problem that sort of keeps coming up is, like you mentioned earlier, the deployment schedule. You know, these soldiers are only there for a year. They learn a bunch of stuff. Then they have to hand it off to someone else. Do you think that a lot of these commanders really took those lessons back there with them?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of guys did. I mean, Lauren Crow, when he was a company commander out at Fob Blessing in the Petch, he was operating with accumulated experience of having already spent a year in the province previously. And Afghans remember him as a guy who did a good job working with the Afghan troops, who wasn't overbearing, who wasn't trying to put an American face on everything. Now, he was part of a battalion that didn't always take that same approach. So the influence of any junior leader like that, no matter how much they've learned and how well-meaning they are, can be pretty limited to their particular little sphere of influence. Now, there are other guys who have, you know, risen farther up the ranks and have, you know, have accumulated experience in this area as well, often just by the luck of the draw. Just, you know, spend 20 years fighting in Afghanistan, you will wind up with some guys going back to the same places over and over again. And we now have guys in 1, 2, 3, and even 4-star general positions who are Petch veterans, and in some cases are guys who did multiple tours there. There's a guy who recurs through the book named Joe Ryan, who's currently back in Afghanistan on what I believe is his 8th deployment there, plus a couple Iraq deployments. He went to the Petch very early on during one of the big special operations pushes there in 2003. He was the battalion commander there in 2010 when I first visited the place, who was kind of realizing that this was not accomplishing anything anymore. And then in 2018 to 2019, he was back in the Northeast as the 1-star senior advisor to the Afghan National Army. And one of the things that he describes is his Petch experience as a battalion commander and previously kind of making him jaded on the idea of when the Afghan government is saying, we need to get out to this district is falling, we need to do something, giving him some perspective to say, look, we actually don't need to do anything, and we certainly don't need to commit American troops to doing.
Mm-hmm. And was that instinct sort of born out of the self-licking ice cream cone effect where, you know, if U.S. troops start going out there, they're just going to be engaging in firefights that otherwise wouldn't be happening?
Right. I mean, that was certainly Colonel Ryan's perspective, was that he had been there at a point when the returns had already diminished and when U.S. forces really were the problem or were one of the big problems in the valley. So he had also seen, you know, the degree to which Afghan forces can really become totally reliant on U.S. forces for a variety of things, everything from logistics to air support. And if the idea is that you don't want to be in Afghanistan forever, kind of that those Band-Aids have to be pulled off eventually.
Right. And I think we should be specific. You know, it's not like the U.S. forces just, you know, all of a sudden packed up and the U.S. military presence in the region was just completely done. There was a drone war going on at the time as well. So I was wondering if you could maybe describe what that was like in the Petch and maybe give some details about Operation Haymaker, how it started, why it started.
Sure. You know, a decade ago, the CIA drone campaign in Pakistan was in the news a lot. What has never really been covered in the same way is there was the Joint Special Operations Command, the military side of kind of the secret counterterrorism operations, started executing its own drone campaign, especially in the Petch and the valleys surrounding it, starting in late 2011 and then really ramping up in 2012 and 2013, essentially because the Special Operations Commanders by that point, I mean, they were burned by Kunar and Nuristan, both by the enemy activity there and the terrain just continuing to cause losses to their units. I mean, these are small units, Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, the Ranger Regiment, where every loss is a big deal. And the Petch had cost a helicopter full of SEALs and Special Operations Aviators back in 2005. A senior SEAL admiral had himself been in a non-lethal helicopter crash there later that same year. And then there had been a series of missions in 2010 in which a SEAL Team 6 operator and two Rangers had both died, and another mission in which a hostage had been killed during an attempt to rescue her. So General Joe Votel, who was the JSOC commander at this time in 2011, he essentially made the decision that we're not going to do ground raids up in these valleys anymore. They're just too risky. And the technology had kind of, both the technology and the tactics associated with it had matured to the point where now a very concerted drone campaign was a thing that could be done. And they put this into effect and waged a pretty relentless air campaign for several years up in Kunar and Nuristan with the idea of keeping pressure on local militants who were harboring Al-Qaeda figures. It was often very difficult to find the Al-Qaeda figures themselves, which often there would be a debate within the Joint Special Operations Command Task Force about, you know, look, we're just killing these low-level figures. What's the point of this? Are we accomplishing anything? And the argument would kind of be, well, look, if we're killing all the people who allow the Al-Qaeda guys to operate up in these mountains, then even if we're not killing the Al-Qaeda guys themselves, we're making their job impossible. We're making it so what they're trying to do is survive rather than what they're trying to do is plan attacks overseas. And which of these you're really doing, I mean, it's kind of an unanswerable question. I mean, it's very difficult to collect intelligence from inside these Al-Qaeda cells way up in the mountains, which are closed organizations that are trying very hard not to be detected. But this becomes kind of a core question as the Obama administration decides whether and how to draw down from Afghanistan is how big of a deal is Al-Qaeda up in these mountains and how much do we need to do to keep them from being a menace beyond just the little places where they're ensconced.
Right. And this drone campaign also causes some turmoil within Taliban leadership. I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that a little bit more. What was the psychological effect of this drone campaign in the Petch on the Taliban leadership?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the JSOC task force knew from interrogations of the small number of figures that it was continuing to capture that the drone campaign was quite terrifying. It really scared militants up in these areas, and it did kind of drive them to push the Al-Qaeda figures they were hosting up into ever deeper crevices within these valleys, which is the intended effect. Now, a downside is if you're just whacking people with drones every night rather than going out and capturing them, you're working yourself out of intelligence sources in many ways. You're not collecting evidence from raid sites. What can happen is you eventually... It becomes hard to judge the effects of your own campaign as the intelligence coming out of it diminishes.
Right. And eventually, sort of fast forwarding a little bit following after the drone campaign, the Islamic State's Afghanistan affiliate comes into the Petch. How did their presence affect the region?
Yeah. I mean, so this is kind of the narrative arc, if you look at it broadly, of the Petch Valley story is U.S. forces went up there looking for a small number of Al-Qaeda figures in 2002 and 2003, whom they did not find and who moved on to Pakistan. That search led to this big counterinsurgency effort. It rolled into this big counterinsurgency effort and a major homegrown insurgency in the area, which itself then brought in Al-Qaeda figures who hadn't been there previously. Who saw this as a fertile place where they could advise and assist local militants, and who also saw it as a sanctuary where the U.S. military would not be willing to risk lives after it had pulled out. Now, the Islamic State shows up starting in 2015, and what the Islamic State is in Kunar is kind of a complicated question. By no means is it the same thing that it is in Iraq and Syria. Often in these little valleys, it's people who have been fighting for, maybe they fought against the Taliban in the 90s, maybe they fought for the Taliban in the 90s, but who had all joined up in this broad-based Taliban-led insurgency against the United States during the 2000s, but who in some cases find the Islamic State to be a better ideological fit. There are a lot of Salafi Muslims up in Kunar for whom the Taliban was never kind of the perfect ideological fit. Or who do it for monetary reasons, or for even simpler reasons than that. I mean, a low-level commander who feels that he's always going to be the number three in his district, but who realizes that he can be the Islamic State's number one in the district, may declare for the Islamic State, and then may switch back again, a year later if it suits him.
Yeah, and then there's sort of this really interesting dynamic that's been playing out even more recently, where the Taliban and the Afghan national government and the United States military sort of, I don't want to say team up isn't the right characterization, but how would you describe their fight against the Islamic State in Kunar?
Sure. Yeah, it's a very strange development that I kind of ended the book with. But in the months leading up to the Doha deal a year ago, even as the United States was hammering the Taliban all over the country to try to bring them, to the peace talks in Doha and get them to agree to favorable terms, up in Kunar, it was treating the Taliban a little differently. Because up in Kunar, the Taliban and the Islamic State were at each other's throats in the same old valleys where American troops had long fought, in particular the Korangal and little side valleys to the north and south of the Petch. So from the U.S. perspective, the Islamic State is a counterterrorism threat in the same way that Al-Qaeda is. Now, whether that's really true or not, I think is a really valid and open question, because so often these Islamic State cells up in Kunar were not foreigners. They were Korangalis or other local cells who had sort of declared themselves Islamic State. But because they are at least nominally affiliated with the bigger Islamic State enterprise, the U.S. military and intelligence community saw them as counterterrorism targets. And so anybody who's fighting them kind of winds up being, an enemy of my enemy is my friend type of situation. So you get this weird dynamic in late 2019 and early 2020, where the JSOC task force that's running the continuing to run drone strikes out of Bagram, it can't coordinate with the Taliban. The Taliban are still the enemy. It's fighting the Taliban everywhere else. But what it can do is it can figure out what local Taliban leaders need in their fight against the Islamic State. Figure out how can we tip the scale with a drone strike against this particular machine gun nest this morning when the Taliban go up this hill against the Islamic State. And so I talked to, you know, rangers in the task force who were involved in this. And it definitely is something that left a queasy feeling, I think, in a lot of stomachs, you know, in some sense, supporting these same militants who for years and years and years you've been fighting. But it's also, you know, as some of them put it, I mean, when you've been doing this just endlessly, you may want to be outside the wire, you know, going on raids, doing the fight yourself like you always used to. But if you've been doing it long enough, you know that, you know, something new may be needed.
Right. And when was the last time that you visited the Pech?
I haven't been to the Pech in years. I mean, the last time I was in Afghanistan was in 2017, and I was not able to get up to Kunar that time because of the rise of the Islamic State. So things that I had done previously in 2013, go and embed with the Afghan National Army up there, were not really on the table anymore. It would have been too much of a risk to me, and also too much of a risk to the, you know, the people I inevitably would have had to employ to accompany me, driver, interpreter, and so on. So that was a decision in 2017 was, okay, it's going to be better. I mean, if the purpose of this visit is to interview Afghans about their experience of the American war there, Kunaris are constantly filtering in and out of Kabul, including from Taliban areas. I mean, I would do group interviews with men from places way up in the Wygal Valley in Nuristan who were visiting Kabul to talk to their parliamentarian on a 10-day pass from the Taliban, which was always an interesting thing to kind of, you know, feel out what they were and weren't willing to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, not that there would be, you know, sort of, there's any reason for a consensus to sort of develop amongst the people who live there, but, you know, what did they tell you the Pech Valley was like getting a 10-day pass from the Taliban? I mean, it seems like they pretty much control the region.
Absolutely, they do. You know, it was for a while there, the mountains were contested between the Taliban and the Islamic State. The Islamic State is pretty much gone now. On the Pech Valley floor, and up in a couple of district centers farther up, like Want District Center in the Wygal Valley, the government remains in control. And that varies from the government is genuinely in control of the town to the government is literally just in control of the physical district center building itself and a few little outposts around it. So, you know, if you go anywhere beyond that, up to the villages on the mountainsides, yeah, the Taliban is their government, and they have to live with it. And I think there's a lot of bitterness, especially in places that, you know, in Kunar and Nuristan, those were not controlled by the Taliban pre-9/11. So there's a lot of bitterness that the American involvement kind of has brought about this Taliban control.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that you always think the Pech is sort of foreshadows or is a few steps ahead of what's eventually going to happen in the entire country in Afghanistan. And I'm wondering if you think that's true, especially now, you know, when we're looking at peace negotiations with the Taliban that are ongoing right now. I mean, do you see that system that you just described as what the country might look like?
Conceivably. I mean, it's very hard to predict. A lot of different things could happen in Afghanistan over the next year. It could take a lot of different directions. But the fact that the United States has kind of had to reach this accommodation, even before the Doha deal, had to reach this strange accommodation with the Taliban, and the Afghan government itself was reaching these strange accommodations with the Taliban against the common foe of the Islamic State, I think suggests the kind of complicated alliances and new and less precedented uses of U.S. intelligence and counterterrorism forces that we may wind up seeing.
Right. And so just to give our listeners a little bit of an update, what's your read on the current status of the negotiations?
I'm not sure I want to venture too much of a guess on that. I mean, I focus very closely on, you know, one area of northeastern Afghanistan where the insurgent movement there is, it's different and unique. It's not very closely associated with the bigger, you know, the Quetta-Shura Taliban movement. So I'm not sure I want to venture too much analysis on something that I'm not really qualified to.
Right. That's fair. Very, very fair. So with a lot of the veterans that you've spoken to, and you've touched on this a little bit, you know, when they look back on their time in the Pech, what's their view now, especially as they watch the U.S. government negotiating with the Taliban and negotiating with a lot of these militant groups?
I think it runs the gamut. You know, I'm in touch with a lot of guys all the time who are still in the military, who still keep a close eye on the places that they served, and also with a lot of guys who just, you know, it's in the past. They're not interested. And I think these are both, you know, totally reasonable responses to kind of searing experiences that guys went through during their year or 2 years if they did multiple deployments up in that part of the country. One thing that's really interesting to see is kind of the nostalgia. I mean, there's a guy who appears at the very end of the book. He's still a senior enlisted, a senior NCO in the Army in an advisory unit. And he describes essentially seeing on a drone feed back during a subsequent tour in Afghanistan in 2019, seeing that the Taliban and ISIS are fighting in the same old place that he had first seen combat in 2006, and just feeling overwhelmed by nostalgia for that 2006 deployment and wanting to be back there. And he posts on Facebook about it. And kind of everybody chimes in with this same kind of grim nostalgia, guys from his old platoon. And I literally saw him posting almost the same thing again this morning, you know, how much I missed that 2006 to the 2007 Korengal deployment, which I think if you told him that in 2006 or 2007, I think he probably would have found that pretty unbelievable given the conditions that he and his platoon mates were laboring under at the Korengal outpost at that time.
Yeah, definitely. I think that might be a good place to stop. So thank you so much for joining me, Wesley.
Thanks so much for reading the book. I really appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.